Welcome everybody to a new season of the Quantum Gravity Seminar, EAPI. Today, the season premiere is with Francesco Guzzini, who's from Marseille. He's gonna talk about advances in numeric techniques for spin foam amplitudes with applications. So as usual, if you have questions during the talk, raise your hand with the Zoom little icon, and I will let you ask your question. But if you can, please refrain and keep questions for the end. And as usual, we're going to start with students and postdoc first, and then try to move to the rest of the questions. So I guess we can get started. And Francesco, please go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Daniele. So welcome everybody to my talk. I will present you part of the work that I've done in Marseille during the last 2 years, mainly in collaboration with my supervisor, Carlo Rovelli, with Francesca Vidotto, and with other people in Marseille, especially Simone Speziale, Giorgio Sarno, and Pietro Donà. As you can see from the title, since I have written a lot of code, I will tell you a lot about numerics. So let's start, and here is the plan of my talk. I will start by quickly introducing you the main ideas of spin foam theory. And in particular, I want to present you a formulation of the PRL model that is very important for our computations. Then I will introduce you the software library that we wrote in the last 2 years and that we are actively using nowadays. The library is called the Search2C Foam, and is a C library for computing APRL transition amplitudes. I will go into more details soon about the library. Most importantly, I will present two applications of our code. The first application is about spin foam cosmology, and is a project that started with Francesca Vidotto a couple of years ago. We have a paper out that uses a single vertex model, but recently I extended the code and the model to many vertices. So we present you the implications of the extension and the preliminary results. The second application that I want to tell you about is about the so-called flatness problem of spin foam theories. I will give you a super fast introduction to this problem. And then I will go on presenting a work that I'm going to publish soon together with Pietro and Giorgio. We were able to use our code to get very valuable numerical insights into the resolution of the problem. And finally, I want to introduce you some very, very recent developments that can boost our code to a new level of performance. This new code is still not stable, but I find that the new developments are quite exciting. So I would like you to tell you also about this new code. Okay, so let's start with spin foams. So some quick recap. In covariant LQG, we define transition amplitude between quantum states of the geometries on abstract graphs. We can think of these graphs as duals to geometrical triangulation made by four simplices, tetrahedra, triangles, and segments, these in four dimensions. And then a spin foam, and here is a cartoon representation, is a graph that I also may call too complex. It's a graph made of vertices, edges, and faces. If you define, if you take a gauge group G, then faces of the spin foam are colored by representations of G, and edges are colored by intertwiners that are invariant tensors in the tensor products of G. The, of course, there is a relation of this cartoon, this spin foam, with gravity, and the relation is that on the edges, we associate the metrics of parallel transform between two vertices, modulo cage invariants, while the faces are associated to the smearing of the frame field along the dual hypersurface to the face. There is a geometrical interpretation, so in four dimensions, for example, the vertices are dual to four simplices, edges are dual to tetrahedra, and the faces are dual to triangles. The boundary of spin foam defines a lower dimensional spin network state. And the spin foam represents one term of the expansion of the discrete gravitational path integral. Here I wrote down a simple form of the gravitational path integral. If we regularize the path integral on discretization of the space-time manifold, in the end, we write down the partition function that corresponds to the spin foam graph. And you can see the form of the partition function. It is the sum over the bulk decrease of freedom, yeah, the JEF and the intertwiners over the edges. The sum of these degrees of freedom of the products of phase amplitude, edge amplitude, and importantly, vertex amplitude. The vertex amplitude contains the dynamics of the model. So if we take classically a Lagrangian that I wrote down here is L equal B wedge F, we have what is called a topological BF theory of the gauge group G, where B is a generic true form and F is another true form in, is a true form. That is the curvature of the G connection on the manifold. And the quantum discretized version of this theory are well understood for the compact cage group SU2, and they are the Ponzano-Reggio model in three dimensions, where the vertex amplitude is the 6A symbol, and in four dimensions we have the Oguri model and the 15J symbol. Of course, we are interested in quantizing gravity. So what is done in spin foam theory is to start from BF theory and then modify it in two ways. The first modification is, of course, to take the Lorentz group as the gauge group. So here there is the SL2C, that is the double cover, as usual, of the Lorentz group. And then, importantly, to introduce the so-called simplicity constraint to break topological invariance and impose the metricity of the underlying G connection. The APRL model is one of the models, it's the model that is the most used nowadays in covariant quantum gravity and implements the simplicity constraints at quantum level in a weak sense. I don't have time to go into the details of the APRL model, but here I wrote down the main ingredient, that is the so-called Y gamma map that maps the irreps of SU2 to irreps, to particular irreps of SL2C in a way that imposes the simplicity constraints at the interface between the vertices. The model is well studied, but there are still open questions. In particular, we are not still sure that the constraints are imposed correctly. And the consequence is that we are not sure about the classical limit on the theory. And I would say that we are not even completely sure about how is the correct way to approach the classical limit of the theory. There are, of course, positive results about the PRL model, and this is why it's the most interesting model. In particular, we have the well-known single vertex asymptotics of Barrett from 2009. And then we have also the extension to the many vertices case by Han and Zhang. Nevertheless, the questions are not completely settled in full generality. So there are still things to study. And here in particular, I outline a numerical path to study these questions, to apply the model to physically interesting settings. I want to introduce you quickly to a formulation of the APR model that is very important for our code, because it is the foundation of the way we do the computations. We follow the work of Speziale, of Simone, from 2016, actually. And following this work, we compute APRL vertex as the convergence sum over shells, what we call shells, of the composition of the normal BF vertex, that is the 15J symbol, with what we call booster coefficients, that are inserted along the edges. On the right, you can see a picture of the process. So at the top, you see the Y map along one edge, and then you can see the splitting of the map into the product of two booster coefficients that are the symbols with the ellipses. And I also put the formula for the booster coefficient. You can see that it is the contraction of two Wigner for J symbols. These are the symbols in parentheses with a rapidity integral along R or of the product of four of these coefficients that we call these small coefficients, and these are related to representation theory, recoupling theory of the Lorentz group. Okay, so when we have this splitting, we can write down the code for the computation of a single vertex amplitudes, and here I put all the steps for a single vertex amplitude. So we start by fixing a boundary state, that can be a spin neutral state or a coherent state. And we also fix a number of shells, and we call this parameter delta S. This is a parameter that must be imposed at the beginning because the sum over the shell is in theory infinite. And of course, we cannot do an infinite sum on the computer, so we have to put a cutoff. Then we have to study the convergence in this cutoff. As a second step, we have to compute all the 15 J symbols and all the booster coefficients for all the shells that we want to add to the computation. Then we multiply and sum all these quantities over all shells, and we contract with the boundary state, and then we study the convergence if it's needed in the shell parameter. These are all the steps that are necessary to compute a single vertex amplitude.
Then sorry, I have a question. What do you call a shell? Sorry. What is the parameter S you call the shell?
The parameter shell gives this parameter delta S gives the number of what we call shells. So I don't have explicit a formula, but you can think that the vertex amplitude is split as a convergent sum in this parameter S. And the more shell we add, the more we push these parameters to 2 or 5 or 10 or 100.
Can you say what S is? Is it R? Is it J? Is it P?
S is an integer, sorry. Is an integer.
Which one?
Is a natural number. Can be from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4.
And what does it label? Is it a twiner, a face?
It's not related to the it's not related to the spin phone graph. I'm thinking about I don't think it has a geometrical meaning. If you put S to 0, you have basically BF but multiplied with these booster coefficients at the boundary of the 15J. So you have the theory that Simone called the simplified PRL model that is very close to BF, but it's not exactly BF because you also have these booster coefficients. Then the more you increase the parameter delta S, the more in the limit we approach the PRL model. But it's not a spin, it's not an intertwiner, it's not anything like that.
But can we think of it as having to do with the imposition of the constraints, like the imposition of the simplicity constraints projected the BF on the on GR? So it's like an expansion in which the more you have terms and the more you get closer to GR, isn't it?
Yeah, you can think of it in this way. Even if I don't, at the moment, I'm not able to think at direct link between the number S and the way the simplicity constraints work, actually. I don't know, maybe Simone, I think, is not connected, but maybe I can think about it, and maybe later at the end of the talk, if I have some more comments about that, I can tell you about. I always thought about it as a computational parameter, a very technical computational parameter. So that does this answer your question partially? Laura?
Yeah, partially. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. So I was talking to you about passing to many vertices. So if we have many vertices, we have to draw the spin from graph and firstly write down all the summations about over bulk intertwiners and bulk faces. And this is not a trivial step because the summations are possibly infinite and the amplitude can be divergent without resorting to some renormalization procedure. So I will not go into that, but for sure, if we have many vertices, we need to put cutoffs here and there if we want to extract a finite number from the machine. Then you have to compute the single vector amplitudes that correspond to all combinations of bulk intertwiners and faces. Then you have to multiply and sum all the combinations, and you have to contract this sum with the boundary state and then study the convergers in all the cutoff parameter. As you might imagine, this is a long process and I would say is it better said than done. But nevertheless, computers are quite amazing nowadays. So when we had to write down our code, we didn't lose our hope. And we proceeded and we wrote down what we call SL2C foam. This is a library for computing APRL transition amplitude. I am personally developing this library along with Giorgio Sarno and Pietro Donà in Marseille. There are also past contributions from François Collet. The library is written in C, the C language, and at the moment consists of about 12,000 lines of code. We use external libraries for various tasks. In particular, we use the great WIG XJPF library for computing the Wigner symbols, the 3Js, 6Js, and 9Js. Then the 15J, of course, we compute using the lower dimensional symbols. And then we use libraries for doing arbitrary precision arithmetic. And also we use OpenMP for parallelizing the code on all the cores of modern CPU. In the library, we have included many tools. Of course, the most important tool is the computation of the APRL for the and 3D vertex amplitudes. When in 3D, I mean a model with the 6J as the inner vertex, and then we add the booster symbols, as in the 4D case. Then we compute also the VF for the M3D vertex amplitudes, we compute the booster coefficients, and also we provided tools for computing SL2C recoupling symbols using also recursion relations for them, and also utilities for computing Levine Speciale coherent states coefficients that are used in the boundary coherent states. But the main task remains the computation of for the Lorentzian APR vertex amplitude. There are many functions for doing that, but the simplest one takes as inputs the 15 boundary spins, so 10 spins for the faces and 5 intertwiners, the Barberin-Mirzi constant, and then the number of shells.
Question?
Sorry? Yeah?
A couple of questions. Can you verify the recurrence relations for the BF model and verify that it's topological? If everything is...
I'm not sure that you are talking about the same recursion relation. So these are recursion relations that are used to compute the recoupling symbols of S2C. So they relate the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients of SL2C.
Yeah, I think they're the same. The question is, since you're representing the functions all numerically, do you have enough precision to verify explicitly that the BF theory is topological?
We never thought of this test with BF theory, actually, using the recursion relation. This could be very interesting. Our code uses arbitrary precision arithmetic. So in principle, we can have all the precision we want. And in fact, for computing the recoupling symbols of SL2C with the recursion relation, we had to use a lot of precision, because if you do things recursively, you have to start with a very, very high precision, because you lose precision at each step. So this is working for computing the higher symbols. So I think in principle it will work for the test that you ask. We might try to do that, because it sounds like an interesting test.
Okay, and another question. Can you turn on the cosmological constant and go to the quantum group?
No. Okay. No, we have not implemented that.
Okay.
So we don't have the quantum deformed symbols. Maybe we can think about implementing them. For the moment, they're not there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. And you can see an animated GIF at the bottom of the slide. And this the process of writing down a very simple program that computes the amplitude of four simplex with all the spins set equal on the boundary. Then all the intertwine is zero, and Barberi-Mirzi constant 0.2, and one shell. So you can see that it's like four or five lines of code. And then we init the library and free the library, and that's all. So then the program must be compiled, of course, with GCC, and then we launch the program. And for a very low spin, here I used the spin one. I write two, but our convention is to put always two times the spin. So yeah, the program was instantaneous. And yeah, as you have seen, for very low boundary spins and very low number of shells, so let's say spins of the order of two and a couple of shells, the amplitudes are almost instantaneous and computed in seconds or less on a normal laptop. And the library works in this way. So the Wigner symbols are all computed just once, along also the booster, they are computed just once, and they are stored into hash tables on these four AUs, because of course it's a waste of time to every time compute these very expensive symbols. Also, the computed amplitudes are stored, so the second time you want to compute the same amplitude, the call is basically instantaneous. Of course, the time grows with power low as the boundary spins or the number of shell increase. And this growth comes from the Simonis formula, because we have to cycle over all combination of four virtual intertwiners and six virtual spins. So a rough estimate of the growth factor is this one. So is the dimension of the spin space to the fourth times the number of shells plus one to the sixth. And I put two graphs on the right that basically confirm this behavior. The blue graph is the scaling with increasing spins, and the red graph is the scaling with increasing number of shells. The first tests of the library were successful. They were done by Simone and George and Pietro and others. And the library was applied to test the large spin asymptotics of the single vertex that was known analytically, both with the BF and Laurentian APRL vertices. And with the Euclidean and Lorentzian boundary condition, you can see on the right the points from an analytical evaluation of the vertex amplitude oscillation, and then you can see agreement with the numerical points. Now I want to go into other applications different from this initial test. So a first application that actually I started working with Francesca is about spin form cosmology. So we can model a closed universe as a topological free sphere. And its simplest regular triangulation is the four simplex, which as I've shown is a dual to a single spin form vertex. So we have 15 boundary spins to these four simplex. We fix the spins of the faces all to the same spin J, and then we leave the intertwiner spins as degrees of freedom. Then we define the state at equal psi zero as in the formula. So you see that its coefficients in the spin network basis are precisely the vertex amplitude of that spin network state. So why this state? Well, this state has an interesting interpretation. We have a unique connected component in the boundary, and we may interpret this connected component as the future one. Then the vertex amplitude, AV, is the amplitude for the transition nothing to that particular spin network state, at least to lowest order in the spin form expansion. And this means that the vertex amplitude describes the amplitude of the transition from nothing to the free geometry that is defined on the boundary. And this means that this state is the analog in Lorentzian LQG of the Hawking no boundary wave function defined with that was defined in his famous work with Hartle. I forgot Hartle Hawking no boundary wave function. This was defined with a Euclidean path integral over compact geometries. The explicit form of the psi zero state is this one. So you see the sum over the five intertwiner degrees of freedom of the vertex amplitude and the tensor product of the intertwiner states on the boundary. The boundary spins J, the 10 boundary spins, determine the 10 areas of the boundary triangles. And the boundary intertwiners are quantum degrees of freedom, and they describe the shapes of the boundary tetrahedra. Or more precisely, they are related to the three-dimensional dihedral angles of the boundary tetrahedra. This is a proper state in LQG, and is a kinematical state, but it contains some dynamics also in a funny way, because there is the vertex amplitude into that. So we can define geometrical observables on the state psi zero, and we can study them as functions of the boundary spins J. Among the observables that we can define, there are the simple intertwiner observables that are related, as I told you, to 3D dihedral angles. Then there is the volume of the boundary tetrahedra. And also in the literature, we can find the length operator of the sides of the boundary tetrahedra and what has been called the 3D scalar curvature, that is actually a transposition to the Hilbert space of LQG of the 3D Ricci curvature of Regge calculus. And this was defined by Alesi and Lewandowski, if I recall correctly. So I'm talking only about operators on the three-dimensional boundary because we have just one vertex and there is no bulk. So we cannot define operators that have some four-dimensional interpretation. We can also look at the entanglement entropy between different groups of tetrahedra. And see how it scales and how it compares to different states that are defined in the literature. And it is interesting to look at the entanglement entropy also because there is a nice formula that relates that bounds actually the correlations of a generic observable to the mutual information that can be computed for a quantum system, and the mutual information is defined in terms of the entanglement entropy of the system. So that's a very generic bound for correlations. So the first results that were later confirmed for more complicated models are these. So the first result is that all the expectation values are compatible with regular tetrahedra on the boundary of a regular geometrical four simplex. So we can say that our model has the correct classical behavior, and that's a good thing. But even if the classical behavior is correct, the fluctuations are large, we found. So the model, let's say, is very quantum. I don't know, maybe I should say it something in a better way, but this was an unexpected result to see such large fluctuations. And then we computed also the correlations, and we noticed that they do not vanish as the boundary spins increase. And then another thing that we found is that the results are qualitatively similar if we use the BF or the Lorentzian APRL vertex. And this depends on the boundary state that we put. So the boundary data that are Euclidean in this case, so they define a free sphere since they are all, since all the boundary spins are equal. They have this consequence that the BF and the Lorentzian APRL computations are very similar. But there is an exception that is the entanglement entropy, and I wish now I'm showing you the plots. So these are the two plots that are from the first publication from the first paper with Francesca. And you can see in the top plot the expectation value of the external tetrahedral angle. So the gray line is the value of the constant value of regular tetrahedron, and you see the numerical points are very close, and we are within four significant figures to the correct value. And in the bottom plot, you see the fluctuation, and you see that they are large and they increase as the boundary spins increase. And they get close to maximal. These were the first operators that we computed, but then I was able to compute some more operators. So here you see the volume operator, and at the top you see the expectation value, you see the fit with the spins scaled to 3/2, and you see the perfect agreement, and of course this scaling is the correct scaling for the volume of a regular tetrahedra as a function of the face areas. And you see at the bottom again the fluctuations that are quite large and increasing. Then I can show you the plots for the Fritti scalar curvature that is basically very close to the length operator, because if we define the scalar curvature as in Regge calculus, that we have to multiply the length of the sides of the tetrahedra with the deficit angles, but the deficit angles are constant because they are tetrahedral angle, the previous plot. So the expectation values of the scalar curvature goes as the length. And you can see the fit that fits perfectly. There is like a proportionality coefficient that changes between the APRL and the DF model, but the growth rate is the same. And then I show you the bottom, the fluctuations that increase almost linearly. It's not a perfect fit. And actually they increase a lot, and they increase probably too much because they grow more than the expectation value. So we don't have an interpretation at the moment for these. It's probably, it can be interpreted as a kind of instability of the model. You can see both the BF point and the EPRL points. and the PLL points look worse. But again, these are results for a single vertex, and I think that this operator is not that significant in the case of a single vertex. And then I show you also the correlate from the first paper, the correlations in the angles, and you see that they do not decrease, they go to a constant value apparently. And then, as I told you, the entanglement entropy. So the two lines, the two gray lines that grows more, that grow more, are the maximum possible entropy of a quantum system with a that number of degrees of freedom. And then the diamonds are the BFKs, that were also called squeeze state by Bianchi and collaborators. And then you can see the APRL case, the points, the circled points that have a sharply different behavior. And also we don't have an interpretation for that. As I told you, I have started to work with models that are more complex and have many vertices, I have more vertices. And this is important actually for three reasons. First, for study correlations between non-neighboring tetrahedra, so because in the case of a single vertex, all the tetrahedra share, they are all connected. And also it's interesting to understand the flow of local observables, how the local observables changes by increasing or decreasing the number of tetrahedra, that is by refining or coarse graining the model. And then also it's interesting to define models with bulk degrees of freedom to compute bulk observables. There is a problem in going to many vertices, and is related to the course of dimensionality. So basically, if you increase the number of boundary tetrahedra, then you increase exponentially the number of values to be summed over. For example, for n tetrahedra, there are 2j plus 1 to the n possible intertwiners to compute. The solution to that is the same as the solution in the case of multidimensional integral. So we can use Monte Carlo sampling in the space of intertwiners. We consider the state psi zero normalized as the density function. And then we can use it to explore smartly the intertwiner space and compute the expectation value of operators without actually computing all the possible intertwiners, that they are really too much. So for example, here you can see in the top right corner a model with 20 boundary tetrahedra, and we were able to compute this. And if you take in the formula to the left, if you take J5, then you end 11 to the 20 possible intertwiners, and they are just too much to put on a computer. So Monte Carlo is necessary at this point. These were the models that we considered so far. So what I call star model, you can see why I call it star. And it's made by five vertices, and it has 20 boundary tetrahedra. Then there is a delta free, what I call delta free. I will describe it also later, more in details, because it's related to the other work that we have done. It has 9 boundary tetrahedra, and then there is the 16 cell that corresponds to the regular triangulation of the free sphere made by 16 tetrahedra, and it has 16 tetrahedra. And this was computed only in BF because we need the topological invariance of BF to compute this stuff and to transform it to a big Wigner J symbol. Because if we split this symbol, this graph into APRL vertices, then we have no less than 8 vertices, I think. And then it was not possible with our present tools to compute that. So the preliminary results about the many vertices model, again, all the expectation values are compatible with the classical corresponding geometry. That's good. And again, the fluctuations are large. The correlations of the operators decrease sharply as the vertex distance increase. And in particular, if we go, if we look at the correlation between different tetrahedra in different vertices, then the correlation are very suppressed. And the boundary observables, again, are similar between BF and the PRL cases, but one bulk of observables that we computed for the delta free depended crucially on the model. So I, sorry, I show you the plot. So this is again the, the external free tetrahedral angle in the star model. So the one with 20 boundary tetrahedra. And you see the light blue line is done with an average over 3 Monte Carlo runs, and the red line was done with an average over 10 runs. And I recall you that Monte Carlo is a stochastic algorithm. So every time we launch a sampling, we get a different number. And then we have to use statistics to extract the result. So you see the agreement with the theory, with the classical counterpart is pretty good. The correlation, as I told you, again, in the star model with 20 boundary tetrahedra, the blue line is the correlation between adjacent, between tetrahedra in the same vertex, while all the other lines that are well below are correlation between tetrahedra in different vertices. And this is the bulk observable. So in the delta free, there is one bulk phase. And we compute the average spin while summing on that bulk phase. And then we can also compute the area of the phase for the classical corresponding geometry, that is the blue line. And then you see that the BF model is very close to the actually to the flat geometrical counterpart, while the PRL model is not that close. And this is a sharp difference that is worth to be investigated. These results are all preliminary, but I think they give us many valuable hints at the same classical regime with many vertices, also about locality of the operators and also non-trivial dynamics, looking at the last plot. And of course, a big goal would be to try to use these models to deduce some experimentally observable consequence. And I thought about it, and we are thinking about it, and we have to think pretty hard, I think, but nevertheless, that would be very interesting. So this is a work in progress. I go into the other application, and we used this work now is done, the flatness problem work is done in collaboration with Giorgio Sarno and Pietro Donà. So we use the library to study the flatness problem spin from theories. This states that the semi-classical limit of the APRL model is dominated by flat geometries. And there are many arguments that support, many, at least three, that support this claim. But here I want to present you the simplest one, actually the first one, that is related to the single vertex asymptotics. You can see the formula on the asymptotics of APRL vertex with coherent intertwiners. And if you vary this formula with respect to the spins J, then trivially the deficit angle must be zero if you set the variation to zero. And this was the first argument, that you find deficit angle zero, then flatness. Of course, there are problems with this approach. In particular, the spins that you vary are not independent of shell of the constraints for which actually the asymptotic formula holds. Crucially, we found that these arguments apply not only to the PRL model, but also to the BF model. So we thought of testing these claims with an exact calculation using our library. We needed a spin-form graph with at least one internal dynamical phase, and here returns the delta free. At the bottom right, you can see the spinform graph, the dual two complex of the delta free. You have three vertices and one internal face and nine boundary intertwiners. And then at the top, there is the like the geometrical representation. That's not very clear because we are trying to represent the gluing of three four-dimensional objects. But you can see the red face, they are actually dual, and this is the bulk face between the geometrical vertices 1, 3, and 5. Okay, quickly, I wanted to present you the steps. So I want to present you a concrete computation. So on the right, you have the amplitude, the complete amplitude for the delta free, written with the Wigner 15J symbols. And then there are the booster coefficients. And oh, sorry, this is the BF amplitude, sorry, no boosters. So you have the complete amplitude and you have the spin form graph, the complete spin form graph at the bottom. Then we defined, of course, we took the dual corresponding geometry, that is the free glue at the four simplices. And we define the three different geometries. One with vanishing deficit angle on the bulk face, and two with non-vanishing deficit angle. For each geometry, we computed the coherence state coefficients, and then we computed the amplitude. So here are the steps. So you have to compute all the bulk intertwiner and all the 15J symbols for all the combinations of these bulk intertwiners. And all the possible bulk spins, x, then multiply and contract with coherent states. Then we have to search for the emergence of stationary phase points, and we use an algorithm that we published recently in classical quantum gravity. And with that algorithm, we were able to detect stationary phase points by looking at sudden peaks in the rolling average over the bulk variables. And this will become more clear if we look at the results. So here we use the Darawal algorithm on the computation over the bulk spin X. So on the X axis, you have X, the bulk spin. At the top, you have the result for the flat configuration with all boundary spins 30. And you see that with the plot says this. So if we take the flat delta free, we compute the bulk area and we find 40.2, and then our computations find a stationary phase point at a numerical spin 40 plus or minus 1. So we can see that there is a stationary phase point with the flat coherent state boundary. But what we computed is also the curve configuration at spin 20, and you can see again that there is a stationary phase point. And its value perfectly agrees with the analytical one. And this is also for the other curve configuration that we tested. So the results are that not only the flat configurations, but also the curve configuration have a stationary phase point. Hence, they are not, we found that they are not suppressed by the quantum BF dynamics. So we thought that this is in tension with the flatness claims. And our suggestion is that the tension is solid, the angles that appear in the flatness arguments are not to be interpreted as deficit angles of the spin connection. That is as a deficit angle Salarige. And the result, this result appears even more puzzling because we know very well the classical BF theory is flat. But what these plots show is that in this case, the BF equation of motion imposes flattening of the S2 connection, but it appears that they do not require the deficit angles computed with an associated metric connection to vanish. And this is the interpretation of the numerical results. We think that this result provides an explicit counterexample to the flatness claims. Of course, there is more work to be done. In particular, we would like to compute with the APRL vertex. and not only with the BF vertex. Then we would like also to find some Lorentzian boundary configuration, especially with the PRL vertex. And then we would like to consider more complex graph with at least one bulk segment that would have non-trivial rigid dynamics. So it would be very interesting to compute a graph that corresponds to that, because then we can compare the emergent quantum dynamics, same classical dynamics from the computations with the non-trivial solution of the Regi equations. There is a problem to this program, that is that already this first computation required considerable time and resources. So you can see in this table that for spin 30, we had to use almost 3,000 hours of time. And this was actually spread over 2 months because we had to launch it in various batches of computations.
Question?
Yes?
Yes, in BF theory, what is the associated metric to the connection? I don't think there is one.
Say that again, sorry.
You talked about the deficit angle of the associated, the metric associated to the connection in BF theory, but there is no metric in BF theory. There is no, you don't solve.
Yeah, there is no metric, sure.
So the connection, the SU2 part of the connection is flat, that's nice, and is, but the metric is not defined, if I understand that.
That's absolutely true. Yes, maybe this is not completely clear, so I wrote an associated metric connection. So of course we in BF we just have the S2 connection and the flat. And the meaning of this sentence is that this does not imply that if we look at a corresponding geometry that has a well-defined metric connection, because we embed the delta free into R4, and if we look at that geometry, we can compute deficit angles, and they are not related to what we see in the BF computations. Right. This is the meaning of the sentence. Maybe that's not.
Of course, it's not related. Anyway, it's very interesting.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the clarification. This sentence it was not very well written. And okay, I'm running almost out of time, but I want you to see, since I was talking about the troubles that we had with this computation, I want to present you some very new developments that we call SL2C from Next for the moment. And this is a new code that we are writing now. And it is a very exciting development, because many instances in computation actually require higher complexity. For example, as I told you, we want graphs with bulk segments, and we would like to compute physical models, amplitudes in physical models, for example, the black hole to white hole. Also, we would like to study refining, coarse graining, and so on. It is possible now that we have much more experience and we know the problem better. It is possible to write much faster code using high performance computing practices and also techniques inspired by tensor networks. So we are currently rewriting most of the code from scratch, and the new version will provide much faster booster computation, much faster vertex assembly, and composition of multiple vertices on the GPU. So a preview of the new code in the buster coefficient will be computed over multiple cluster nodes and with more efficient arithmetic. Importantly, for assembly the vertex, we will use tensor contractions using particular high-performance computing libraries. And you can see the change in perspective. So we have the sum of the bulk variables on the top line, and then we rewrite this sum as the the product of matrices, basically, and then we trace over. Of course, the mathematically, this is just rewriting on this expression, but for a computer, things change considerably, because the matrix product can be implemented very, very efficiently. And then, also importantly, we can compose multiple vertices again with this tensor contraction technique. And we can also use the GPU, that is a technique that's becoming very, very important now. Sorry, maybe I will close the window. Sorry, I'm back again. And we can run the computation over the GPU to get a very, very important boost of performances. So here is the spec to speed up. The first step will be speed up by 100 times. The single vertex assembly more than 1,000 times, and also the multiple vertices composition 1,000 times. This is not the incremental speed up, but each step will be probably, we probably get faster this factor and more. And this is not an estimate, but actually most of the code, for example, for the single vertex assembly is done. And we saw this speed up or even more. We are 4,000 or more. So we can literally pass from months or years to minutes. And that's very exciting. So we think that numerics is starting to play an important role. It's been from theory. And now there are tools to study non-trivial problems, as I have shown to you in this presentation. Soon, we will have more powerful tools to study more complex problems, as I was anticipating to you with the new code. And here I outline some future research directions, some immediate research direction, for example, trying to settle the flatness problem. I think that the computation of the delta free with the APRL vertex will be very quick with the new code. It will be a matter of hours or minutes. Then we can also try to test the semi-classical dynamics of the APRL model using more complicated spin forms. And then we can pursue the spin form cosmology model with many vertices and try to look at more observables. We can also, it would be very interesting to study the renormalization flow using the XL vertex. As far as I know, in the results that have appeared since now, they use the asymptotic formula for the individual vertices to find the renormalization flow. And then, of course, very interesting would be to think of physically relevant models and observables. And okay, I think I have finished here. So thanks for your attention. And you can ask your questions.
Thanks, Francesco. Right, so questions then?
Sorry, thanks. That was a very interesting talk. Looks like great work. And I'm late for another meeting, so I'm just gonna have a very quick question. When you use GPUs, one of the problems commonly is that they use single precision floating point computation. Even if they use double precision, you sometimes need more than that. So how do you get around that problem?
Okay, this is a question that is really to the point. Thanks. So actually you can use double precision on GPU, but of course it's not as fast as using single precision. Mm-hmm. And we plan to use double precision because single precision is not enough. So concretely the maximum exponent of a 32-bit number is not wide enough to contain the amplitudes that we need. From what we saw, the composing the amplitudes with double precision is enough. So actually we had to use the arbitrary precision arithmetic, and this can't run on the CPU, on the GPU, but this is important for computing the booster coefficients. And this is crucial in that. But then once you computed the booster coefficient, you can truncate the result to double precision and then throw everything on the GPU.
Okay, good. Thanks. So I gotta leave, but that was great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for being here.
Okay, other questions?
I don't have anything more to add to the question of Laurent, but I will think about it. And then I will discuss also it with Simone. Probably is the best one for asking such a question. So if I will have some update, I will let you know.
Okay, I also have a question concerning the flatness problem. So you were saying that, you know, what's flat is another connection. Do you have any idea what is that connection that you're talking about? I mean, is it the, you know, Stekar-Barbero connection? Is it some version of it?
So you mean the connection that is flat, that is imposed to be flat by the BF equations?
Yeah, you were saying that there is a flat connection, but it's not the metric connection. So the question is, what is that connection?
No, I say that in the classical theory, that there is a flat connection, of course, it is the connection, the SU2 connection. I'm not saying that in our results we see a flat connection, because actually we see also the curve, that the curve configuration have a stationary phase point. So I would not say that what we see.
So I understand. How do you interpret these stationary points in the curve case? In the curve case, you mean for the EPRL model?
We didn't run the computation for the APRL model. We just ran the computation using the BF vertex.
Sorry, what do you mean by a curve configuration? By a boundary?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So you take the dual triangulation. So this one, you take the three for simplicity, good, and then. You can define the spins and the normals of the boundary in a way that the internal deficit angles becomes R0. So it can be embedded in R4. So it's a flat delta free. Mm-hmm. Or you can define the spins and the normals in a way that the internal deficit angles is different from zero. Then you can no longer embed the free for simplicity into R4. And this we call core configurations. So this configuration of boundary spins and boundary coherent states that correspond to non-zero deficit angle in the dual geometry. So we put these coherent states and these boundary spins in the quantum BF model, and we find the stationary phase points. Mm-hmm. And we know that that BF, the BF vertex and the APRL vertex, they have stationary phase points if some constraints hold, so the closure constraint and shape matching constraint. And we know that then there is a stationary phase point, so this is what we are seeing, I think. But the fact that there is a stationary phase point with boundary configuration that is not flat. I think we think that is in contrast with the flatness claims, because if we interpret the flatness claim correctly, then we would not expect to see these stationary face points.
Is there a subsequent theory analysis of that fact?
Or no.
It's not needed.
No, sorry. Can you say that again?
Yeah, is there something to be done at the theory level to clarify what that means?
Yeah, can I interject a comment here, Francesco?
You mind? Yeah, sure. Yeah, please.
I have a comment which is not from the numerical part, which I can hold much less from the analytical part. And I don't have a definite answer to what to Laurent's question, last question, but there is an hypothesis which has been long debated in Marseille, which is the following, which comes if you look at the other argument for flatness, the one of the Polish Kaminski, whatever. What they show is so they get to flatness in two steps. first, there is you're asking which connection are we talking about here? There is a the simplicity constraint relates boosts and rotations. That's one way of viewing it. So if you go around a face and you force yourself to have a sort of gamma self dual connection, a connection that only in SL2C goes along the direction in which a boost is always proportional to a rotation, then what you find is that this connection is flat when you go around, which means that if you have a rotation on the plane of the triangle, then necessarily you have a boost, and vice versa. And that's exactly the result that they derive. But then they had a second point. The second point is they say, well, this should describe Regge triangulation. They assume this describes a Regge triangulation. Mm-hmm. And as you know, in a Regge triangulation, when you go around a two-dimensional thing, you don't get an arbitrary connection. You have a connection that has to be to preserve the two-dimensional thing. So it's only a rotation in the dual plane. Mm-hmm. So if you impose that, the previous connection I told about generate a rotation and a boost, but the requirement to interpret it as a Regge geometry says that the rotation is zero and therefore the boost is zero, or vice versa. It says the boost is zero and then the rotation is zero. And then you get to flatness. But you don't get to flatness from the flatness of the connection you've computed. You have to get to flatness to the flatness of your connection you've computed plus the particular geometrical constraints on the holonomy around the face that comes from a Regge triangulation. Is that clear?
I think so. It would be nice to see it developed in some sense. I was wondering whether this second requirement, like the zero, usually it's the thing you control by the boundary states, right? Or this is the embedding of the fluxes.
The second requirement, so you mean the Regge requirement, in the work of the Polish, it's just assumed. That's where we see is the source of disagreement with the when you actually computing and when you do the analysis. Because in the analysis, there's this extra hypothesis, which is a Regge geometry. Which is the same extra hypothesis which is assumed in the works of Bianca and Hal. So we think that they work with an hypothesis that is actually not realized in spin form. Spin form allowing zero connection in the sense and non-zero Regge angles, because there is this extra degree of freedom, which is the sort of the rotation of the frame fields going around the two surface, not without keeping the. So in a sense, is your twisted geometries that open up the space, the extra geometrical space. What I'm not able to do is to directly connect this with the delta three calculation that Francesco has been doing, but to show that this scenario is correct. But there is a possible scenario, which is reinforced by what Francesco is doing. So here's a possibility. This, if this was so, all the various pieces would stay together.
Okay, well, it would be nice to develop. I think it matches the new understanding on the continuum that the twisted geometry is the key to access curvature.
Yes, yes. And so if you forget that in spin network, and therefore for sure in spin foam, the discrete geometry is not necessarily a sort of regular geometry or a larger geometry, it's a twisted geometry, then you have room for more, and that's where what makes things coherent.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be nice to develop and bundle it all together.
Can I add a comment?
Yeah, please, Pietro.
Yeah, go on, Pietro.
Laurent, I completely agree with you. That's exactly what we are doing with Simone right now, by the way. And let me just stress one thing that you said that is correct, but probably you're like overlooking a small detail. But you say that the rotation on the plane of the ground is controlled by the boundary coherent state. That is correct. Apart from the triangle that is in the bulk, for which we are not prescribing any coherent state, but we are summing over all the possible coherent states. That's probably where this arbitrariness of this rotation comes from. That's my understanding.
Okay, thanks.
That was it.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I think we can wrap it up. Let's thank Francesco again.
Thanks.
Very good.